If Bitcoin does what we think it'll do, it literally has to do that to the detriment of other assets. I think will probably be the first asset to really have this demonetization sucked out of to move to Bitcoin. I've managed to convince 100 families to adopt Bitcoin. I talk to financial advisors all the time. Most of them think I'm an idiot.
Today, Jim Kreider reveals the hidden tax of Bitcoin asset value destruction. He believes we are on the edge of entering the suddenly phase and explains why nation states will start flooding to build reserves.
Seems that Vivek knows a little bit about it. JD Vance understands it. We have sold some of that 200,000 Bitcoin, so we have to go buy some now. That is much more of a signal move.
Jim and I also discuss another large group of institutions that are on their way to stacking.
You're going to see a wave of people start adopting Bitcoin when they can actually get paid a commission off of it. The first people to adopt it will be old school, like wirehouse broker-dealer types who are selling it as a product, not selling it as advice. The last people to adopt it will be, I think there's a decent chance we are about to enter like the suddenly phase. We're on the right on the threshold.
Yeah, we're looking over the cliff right now. Like, are we going to jump?
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Trying to step up our game here, Jim Kreider. We've got a bull market on the way, and we got to step up the production so that people can get high quality, high definition Bitcoin education. You know.
Yeah, I'm just disappointed you'll have chairs here that we're sitting on.
Well, these are pre 1971 chairs. I bought them at Round Top, the antique fair, 3 years ago, and I made sure I found antique chairs that were made before we ripped ourselves off the gold standard.
Okay, they're quite comfy.
They are. Lindy, very Lindy. Chairs are older than my parents. They're like 60 years old now, 63 years old, 1961.
There you go. Yeah.
You were just telling me you have a perfect hit rate in terms of convincing people to buy Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yes. Somehow, I would say I have the advantage of having a captive audience most of the time. The hard people are, you know, like the people you already know, you know, usually like siblings or old childhood friends, things like that can be the toughest because, mm-hmm. you know, like they perceive you, like if you have a good friend from when you're a kid, they perceive you as like, or at least for me personally, it's like, oh, it's Jim, the goofy 12-year-old who would come over and eat all of our candy or whatever, you know, so they don't perceive me as actually knowing anything. So those are the toughest, but, you know, for a living, people pay me to like tell them what to do with their money. So, you know, they have some weight of trust. Know what I do for like our financial planning clients. Like I've gotten some hate over the years for not like on my website, not talking about Bitcoin and stuff. I do that on purpose. Like most, if your parents or grandparents, like were looking for a financial planner, or let's say you're a normal person and they're looking for a financial planner, they would go out and like, if they saw Bitcoin on the website, there's no way they're going to hire them. So I don't want to scare off like these people's parents or grandparents. I want to captivate them. And then I don't talk about Bitcoin until they've become a client. I've proven that I'm not a moron through like tax planning and stuff. And then finally, once I've demonstrated that maybe you should believe what I'm saying, then I'll bring in Bitcoin. There's an element of trust that you have to really go in deep education. The problem, the education piece is interesting. You have to speak to where they're coming from on their level and what they're interested in. So like, I don't talk about running a node or hash rate or things like that. We talk to like, what's money, the history of money. And most people will find that really fascinating. Like, wow, I never knew that. It's amazing how many people think that we're still on a gold standard.
Oh, it's insane. Like, you literally, like, oh, what's backing the dollar? Like, gold. Mm-hmm. Let's take a step back, though. Like I was telling you, this episode is probably going to drop either Monday or Wednesday of next week. So right before Thanksgiving, right before we hit record, we were looking at the charts. It looks like we may hit a new all-time high today. And so I think having you in the room, in all of your experience convincing people to buy Bitcoin and helping people understand why they should have some exposure to it, we have a good opportunity here for anybody who is currently traveling, whether you're on a flight, you're on a plane, a train, an automobile, on your way home, mentally preparing for the Bitcoin presentation or the conversation that is inevitably going to happen if one of your family members knows that you're into Bitcoin on Thursday of this week. How do you think they should approach the conversation? And I think you just touched on a very important thing, which is meet people where they are and how they're going to be most receptive to Bitcoin.
Yeah, there's that natural tendency to want to be like, I told you so, which there are some people who that's the best approach. It's like, dude, I told you, and you should still buy some. I would say that's probably not, despite what our ego wants to do that most of the time, that's probably the lesser tactic we should take. And the other tactic we should take is more of like subtle humility. Prodding. Like, I don't know, like, there's a book called Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. He was like the top FBI negotiator. And one of the tactics he talks about to help people sort of come to your side of the table is to first allow them to air their grievances or at least just their understanding. So that's really important, I think, with Bitcoin. It's like, what do you think about it? Like, what have you heard about it? What do you know about it? Because you could have the best, you know, oh, it's backed by this and all these things. You get the best arguments in the world. Oh, the US is going to adopt it as a treasury and all these things. But you could be saying those things. But if all they're telling themselves in their head is, yeah, but it's used by drug lords or, you know, it's going to boil the oceans, they're not going to hear anything you say. They're going to wait for you to shut up long enough so they can come in and say that what they think is a trump card. You know, like if you're playing poker and you're sitting on a full house, you're probably not even watching the flop for the rest of the game because you're just waiting until you lay down your hand. And that's what happens if they think that they have a full house with their gotcha. They don't hear what you say. So you have to allow them. Well, what do you think about this? What do you know about it? What have you heard? Let them get off their chest. That way they can actually engage in a dialogue versus being checked out. That's paramount.
Make them flip the cards first.
Yeah. Like, what do you know about it? They're going to want to say it. Like, oh, it's this. Like, okay, yeah, I've heard these things too. And maybe, again, depends on personality. Maybe you go after that thing initially. Like, you know, oh, it boils oceans. Like, oh, yeah, that was a big conversation point back in 2017. And, you know, they're saying by this point in 2020, it would take up all the energy in the world. Like, clearly that hasn't happened. So maybe there's a narrative that informed why they would say these things. Maybe you should bring that up right then. Or maybe you should say, hey, if you really want to talk about this, I will make sure we address that point. But we're going to have to build up to that point. And there's, again, you have to, you know, it's your family you're meeting with for Thanksgiving or close friends. So you know personalities. But most people don't want to be lectured and be told, like, I told you so.
Have fun staying poor. Let's not drop any have fun staying poor this Thanksgiving, okay? I know you guys want to, but let's just keep that one in the cage.
There's a very limited people who really, they enjoy that banter. So you know who those people are. You can, those type of people, it's good for them. They need to be shaken up. But for the most part, you know, they need to be grabbed by the hand, taken in. It's going to be okay. Here's what's happening. So, yeah. And most people don't want to sit down and have a lecture at, like, again, like hash rate or something for like 40 minutes. Like, they're, you know, hey, let me eat my turkey and some pie. So again, trying to appeal to what they're going to find important, which I guess, frankly, they're going to look at number go up and say that that's the most important thing, which, I mean, that's probably why 99.9% of us bought Bitcoin initially is because of number go up. So you have to speak to that to some capacity. But again, if you only speak to number go up, the problem with that is if number goes down, they're going to come to you and say, I knew I shouldn't have bought it. So you have to anchor into why does number go up over a long trend? And that requires anchoring into like a deeper narrative. And again, that's how I approach it. It has to be informed by like, what is money? What's stores of value? Not just over the last few years. Most people think that what money is what they see today versus what historical money has been. It takes a deeper understanding. And once you can step people into identifying these things, they start realizing the US dollar is total trash. Like, they'll come to these natural conclusions on their own. It's like, we understand this not because we're like outrageously smart, just because, like, yeah, I've seen a little bit more than I think maybe you have. The moment you see it, you can't unsee it.
That's the truest part about Bitcoin, is like, once you see not only how Bitcoin works and the value prop it provides, but alternatively, the dollar system, the fiat system, and how systemically broken it is and the incentives of that system. It's like, oh, you can't unsee that. And everybody's feeling inflation.
Yeah.
I mean, many people are arguing that is the main reason why Donald Trump just won. I don't know if you call it re-election, but he's going to be our president again. Maybe it's re-election, but inflation. So that's obviously going to be top of mind for people this Thanksgiving as well.
Yeah. I was talking to someone yesterday. They were talking about investment approach and normal money stuff. And I don't think our money's really that broken, is it? And I just brought up how, you know, whatever, 40% of our money in circulation has been printed in the last couple of years. And like just that one little thing, you know, it's a matter of like helping people get off balance. They think that what's happening right now is status quo, and that's how things have always been. And you can just sort of nudge them where they realize maybe my feet aren't as steady as I thought. That's step one. And again, that's easier to do. Like if you come at them abrasively and you knock them off balance, they might grab you out of frustration. But if you nudge them out of place of compassion, they might grab your shoulder out of like leaning on you. And there's that, it can feel sort of the same, but I think most of us know when we're doing, which way we're taking it.
Yeah. I mean, I've certainly honed my pitch over the years. If you talk to Marty at Thanksgiving in 2013, 2014, he was like, you got to get in now. Everything's burning. If you don't get in, like you're going to miss out, and never effective these days.
Well, that's true. It's true. Like,
well, that was going to lead to a question. Like how much of instilling fear is what's the word I'm looking for? How effective is that? In getting people to act?
That's a really good question. This might be just personal personality. The fear itself cannot be driven out of hype, but rather out of like education and conviction. Like I hate anything hypey. Like that's why I don't like big conferences or like social mixers where everyone's like, you know, whatever. You're getting pumped up on things because that's purely emotional based. Like if you went to a nightclub where it's like, that is pure hype. Everything's there built up around this thing. If you were to flip the lights on in that situation, like the environment would die itself because the whole environment is not built off of like depth and relationship and healthy community. It's based off of like dim lighting and loud music. And the moment that's stripped away, like, you realize it's really shallow. And I think that's how a lot of times we can try to approach this fear-based tactic can be... it can be, have fun staying poor. We're all gonna, you know, the ships are burning, all these bad things, which can be true, but
once you turn the lights out, it's not as clear to people.
Yeah, like wait, hold on. Yeah, the price drop. What do you mean? You know, like I thought this was gonna go up only because, you know, I thought we were gonna enter hyperinflation in the next 2 years. What happened? You know, well, I thought the halving period, you know, it's like, here comes the halving, this is your last chance. Halving takes place 6 months later, it hadn't really moved that much. You know, I hear that all the time. I thought this whole thing was supposed to be the big move. And it's like, no, like if you anchor into purely fear without allowing that to be informed again by something deeper. I feel like a sort of a broken record, but it has to be anchored in something more than just like purely emotion. Emotion being excitement out of hype, fear-based. I guess those two things, like excitement or greed or fear. And either of those can be good sticks and carrots, but neither of those are going to bring... you're always going to have a stick or a carrot versus putting inside of someone. Like... once you own Bitcoin, like I relish the opportunity. You know, part of me sort of wanted Kamala to win, just so Bitcoin, I personally thought that if Kamala won, I would think that Bitcoin would sort of go dormant for a few years based off of attacks, not just specifically on Bitcoin, but all over like privacy in general. And it was like, all right, that's a silver lining if she would have won. It's like, cool, I'll buy some cheap Bitcoin for several years. I have that of like, sweet, I'll scoop it up for several years because I have that deep internal conviction. But if it was carrots and sticks only, I probably wouldn't have that like, cool, I'll get to buy on the cheap. You know, if you want to buy the dip, it's because you have that intrinsic motivation versus fear-based. That's why you see people, you know, the halving cycle, you know, people get wiped out at the bottom because their carrot, they feel like their carrot just got snatched away versus having that deep internal understanding of what this thing is.
What's up, freaks? This rip was brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. We've got a special event for you, an online event. Bitcoin is hitting its stride with massive ETF inflows, major geopolitical changes, increasing corporate adoption, and a proposed U.S. strategic reserve. 2025 is shaping up to be a defining year. I think it's pretty safe to say that if you've been paying attention. You probably should be. Here's a real question you need to be asking yourself. Are you ready? Is your Bitcoin house in order? If you're not sure, you're in luck. On December 10th, Unchained is hosting the central session focused on helping you get positioned for what's ahead. You walk away with a clear path to your end of year moves, smarter strategies for bringing your family into Bitcoin, and the confidence of knowing you're set up for the long haul. Join Unchained General Counsel Jeff Vandrew and Adamant Capital founder Ter Demeester, both have been on this podcast many times, to understand what makes this moment different and the key moves you need to consider from year-end planning to bring your family into Bitcoin the right way. With the bull run gaining momentum, this is your window to get ready for what's ahead. Register at unchained.com/TFTC. Unchained.com/TFTC.
This rip is also brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. CoinKite builds the best Bitcoin hardware in the world. There is no second best when it comes to Bitcoin hardware. If you're looking to secure and self-custody your Bitcoin, you can get the MK4 or the ColdCard Q. ColdCard Q has a full keyboard, a QR scanner, NFC enabled, has a battery pack, put some AA batteries in there, create private public keys off pair in an air gap fashion. Private keys never have to touch an online device. They have their Sats card, which is the best way to give Bitcoin. If you're looking to gift Bitcoin for a wedding, a birthday party, a communion, a bar mitzvah, whatever it may be, tap the card on the back of your phone. You get a address to send to. You send it to that address. It lives on the Sats card. Again, there is no second best when it comes to Bitcoin hardware. The Bitcoin price seems to be going up. You want to take care of your security before Bitcoin goes to six figures. Make sure you get your Bitcoin off exchanges using CoinKite hardware, MK4, ColdCard Q. Go to CoinKite.com. Use the code TFTC. We have a code now, TFTC, for 5% off at checkout.
No, and I really want to dig into meet people where they are. And what I've found to be most effective in recent years is asking the question. I think it's really important if the Bitcoin conversation comes up, and particularly if you don't force the conversation and somebody asks you, you start, it's like, all right, how would you describe Bitcoin, or how do you view Bitcoin? Let's start there. I think that's like the most important opening for these conversations at the Thanksgiving table. It's, all right, what do you understand Bitcoin? How do you think Bitcoin works? What do you think it is? And then go from there.
Yeah. That does two things. One, and again, it disarms people from that narrative they have built up. And two, it helps you, maybe they are super smart, know about this. You're not speaking way below them, but most likely you don't understand much at all. So you're not going to speak way above them. I was hanging out with some people a few months back, little gathering that I host. And there are a few ladies in there who said, hey, I just want a Bitcoin 101. So everyone came around, we were having a Bitcoin 101. And, like 40 minutes later, Preston's talking about supercomputers and like AI. And I could tell like these people who wanted 101, their eyes were glazed over. It was pretty funny. And I think that's what we tend to do is we want to, not that Preston was doing this, but personally, like you want to demonstrate your depth of knowledge and show how robust this field is versus just meeting at the simple place of what they have questions about. They can build on that. Like day one for Bitcoin for me was not hash rate and all these things. Like I was amazed by the difficulty adjustment, things like that, but I didn't need to understand it. I got there after a bit and understood like, okay, this thing's really cool. I'll learn about how this works later on. But those were built on layers of like, for me personally, how I really started to understand Bitcoin was March of 20, right before the COVID shutdowns, there was talks about it. And I'd been dabbling in Bitcoin since 15, but didn't understand it. It was more like this investment. It goes up, I buy some, whatever, you know. But yeah, March of 20, talks of the government shutting things down, but oh, it's okay. They'll probably give us money anyways to keep things going along. I realized like, that's not how money works. So my basis of learning about Bitcoin was, okay, our money clearly is broken if they can just arbitrarily create it and give it out. So what in lieu of that is the best form of money? And I thought I need to look at real estate, gold, Bitcoin. Those would be the best forms of like long-term stores of value. I just go on walks every day for several hours. You know, at that point, everything was closed. So I would just go on walks and learn about Bitcoin and all these things. So yeah, my foundational approach was like, what is money? And again, that's where someone asked me like, Jim, what's Bitcoin? I think the best question is Bitcoin is money. Again, some people have other things that resonate with them more, like, oh, Bitcoin is more of like the sailor type things of supercomputer, blah, blah, blah. It's like, but like, you know, your aunt at the dinner table next or this week is not going to want to hear like it's a group of, you know, cyber hornets protecting this thing. It's going to be like, it's money. It's a better form of money. And here's why.
Yeah. And I actually had this conversation last night. My wife's aunt, it's really my wife's aunt's sister-in-law, but she's essentially part of the family. She's in Austin. We had drinks with her and her boyfriend. And this question came up and they had a friend with them. And she asked, what is Bitcoin? And going back to like answering, like, it's money, better money. And then there's many ways to describe it. And I bounce ideas off each other here for to send people away to their dinner with some frameworks. But I think it was effective last night. Like I approached it from the control of the monetary system first before even diving into 21 million divisibility, saleability, all that stuff. It was like, it's just better money that can't be controlled by central authorities. We live in a world which governments and central banks have very strict control over the money, and they can decide on a whim what to do, whether lower interest rates, increase interest rates, expand, contract the monetary policy, monetary base, excuse me. Bitcoin's different in that there is no individual business, central bank, government that can decide to change the money. And then you go from there like, oh, so it's like you have this hyper-controlled system that very few people can change and this somewhat anarchic system that cannot be changed trivially, if at all. And then you dive into the properties of money. Like, by the way, there's only 21 million Bitcoin. And that is going to essentially win out the monetary competition in the long run, because people will vie for the scarcer monetary asset.
Yeah.
Bad approach?
Terrible. No, I think that's great. The overarching theme of, if someone can control and manipulate it, that impacts inflation and the introduction of new units. So yeah, I think that is the most important thing. It is something that cannot be controlled by an individual, a group of people, a government, a corporation. And one of the most important factors of that is as a fixed supply that can't, again, be created by an institution. That is foundationally why Bitcoin is important. And I think it helps, again, to look at this from an historical lens, because you might say, well, yeah, that's not really a risk. But if you help them understand, like, the manipulation through governments, people, corporations over time, like talking about, you know, I mean, all these classics we all know from reading Bitcoin Standard and everything. But it's like, all right, glass beads. You know, I think people realize the frustration with the hijacking of money when you actually tell real stories. It's like, yeah, glass beads. Like, there's a reason that so many like groups in Africa were impoverished is because their money was hijacked by foreigners that had an easier way of, you know, creating money. Same thing with, you know, talking about the Rhinestones. It's like, yeah, this dude came in, O'Keefe came in from, what was it,
from Scotland? Ireland.
Yeah. He sailed in, realized that their money really wasn't that hard. He could create more units. And they start realizing like, okay, yeah, this is starting to, this sounds sort of familiar. Then you talk about, you know, Rome, like, yeah, individuals, you know, I'm sitting there, I don't know how many, if I was a, maybe I made swords or something, I don't know how many swords a day I need to sell. So I figured I'd probably sit around in my booth a good amount of time throughout the day. So I just start whittling down some coinage. So I'm sure individuals were creating inflation on their own by whittling down and then, making some denarii on their own. And then the government confiscating and selling. So it's like, okay, yeah, that makes sense, but that's not modern. And then you introduce them to like, well, heck, look at, you move into the 20th century and go to Germany post-World War I, move into, man, talk about the confiscation of gold. Like, that blows people's minds. That actually happened. Like, that's less than 100 years ago. And just, yeah, this happened by force. And immediately after, the value of gold was repriced. Gold didn't suddenly become more valuable. Your dollar became much more less valuable. And it's these wake up calls. It's like, okay, this, it's starting to hit closer and closer to home, and you're hitting it from different points, different types of people groups, individuals, nations, all this intervention. You're seeing a theme here. And then you go into, yeah, Bretton Woods, this gathering of people who are, you know, get together and think of a way to centralize control further in the 1971. And then by the time you hit that, it's like, wow, this really is bad.
This is
like,
my lifetime now.
Yeah, this is starting to sound like Rome. Like, this is starting to sound like these other things. I can see it now. And then what I do personally is I don't, from there, we might talk about, like, petrodollar system. I typically don't go there, but we'll leave off, like, really at 1971. And then I'll fast forward to, like, cryptography and internet money, to address the fact that, like, this is not something that, like, some bro started creating in 2014 so he could buy a Lamborghini. I think that's what a lot of people have in their head. It's like, it's some young money that young kids use. They can hype it up and make a lot of money. So you have to address, like, no, this is something that was even being thought about since the 70s. Like, the dawn of really the internet is exchanging value online. And then 80s was being sort of worked on. The 90s was really this rise of insanely smart people really trying to think through this, but they kept coming across two problems. And I just explained, like, real quickly, like, the two problems was digital scarcity and this, like, this ledger system that can't be manipulated by a single person. And no one could fix it. Like, no one could solve these problems because it's really tough. And then out of nowhere, this person came in 2008 and wrote this paper, and they solved it, and they showed their work, and they cited their sources. So you're starting to build up on, like, it's a credible thing that's been trying to be solved for decades, rather than there's this, if Bitcoin is presented as just, hey, it'll help you make a lot of money, it seems like an arbitrary, you're competing against every other stock or cryptocurrency or whatever. And if you don't present it as a solution to something that they are aware of, they think that you're trying to create a solution that is to a non-issue. So you have to show that there's an issue here, and you have to distill what that issue is. And if the issue is broken money, they'll recognize you need fixed money. If the problem is, if the solution you're trying to create is how to make more fiat, they might go look at Ethereum or whatever else, because they haven't properly identified the need. So you have to get to that. And that's why, like, deep education on, like, history of money, that's like, oh, crud, our money truly is broken. Bitcoin is money. The rest of those things don't really matter. So it takes a little bit of time, but, like, I didn't have any clients who sold Bitcoin. Like, I had clients who wrote it up to 69,000, wrote it down to 16,000, zero clients sold. I had several clients reaching out, like, hey, when are we buying more? And we had a lot of clients scoop up a bunch of Bitcoin, like, hey, we're going to stop contributing to 401ks and all those things, so we can just load up on Bitcoin at 16,000. The only way I can do that for the amount of people I manage money with is to anchor in education. Because, you know, how many people get wiped out every 4 years? Mm-hmm. Do they ride it up high? And then, like, you know, I saw this in the 17 cycle when it hit like 18 or so, then it dropped all the way back down. Like, I remember talking to people who were like old families who were mortgaging their houses and stuff at like $16,000, $17,000 Bitcoin. And most likely the majority of those people sold at five, six, whatever thousand. Had they not done that, they'd be way ahead now. But again, they were probably anchored into either short-term fear or short-term, like, hype greed versus long-term thesis of money systems broken. I even, you know, relate, like, I think it was Charlie Munger a few years back admitted that he doesn't think the US dollar will be the, like, primary, like, global reserve asset by the end of the century. He didn't state what his opinion of it was. He's pretty sympathetic to China, or he was pretty sympathetic to China. So maybe that. But even people realizing, like, okay, it's not just, like, in their head what they picture a crypto bro being. It's this whole thematic, something's wrong. This does seem like the best solution that I've ever heard. So I should probably own some just in case it catches on.
Yeah. And, I mean, obviously Charlie Munger was never a Bitcoin advocate. Him and how am I forgetting his name? Warren Buffett believed that it was rat poison, but
squared.
But this does get to another point. Human social beings, many of which succumb to herd mentality, like not moving past like what is Bitcoin, why does it exist, how does it work, now going deeper into the sales pitch. Does the social signaling that we're seeing from the Black Rocks of the world, Fidelities, and now nation states play into your pitch at all?
Ish. I don't start there. I don't even get there in the middle. That's like end, because that's the end game from a like game theory perspective. So if I lead off with institutions are adopting or something like that, if let's say Bitcoin drops, I don't know what it's going to go up to. Let's say it goes up to 200, drops to 70. And then BlackRock says, hey, you know what? We're going to get out for right now. If you're anchored into BlackRock owns it, and then BlackRock sells, you're going to sell too. If you're anchored into this is better money, that's not going to change. So we have to start with that and anchor deeply into that. And then allowing, once you understand those things, then we start introducing the whole like the whole game theory side of things. So that's where things really start blowing your mind, is like, it has all these principles. I think a fun way of putting it is like, dude, if I wrote a blog about like baking, and I had 20 people, like moms at home that read my blog, and I would send it out to, and I just issued this blog out, and then I disappeared. And then 15 years later, like nation states and Fortune 500 companies, all these people are talking about that blog, and it's not even a company, like it doesn't exist. Like, that's amazing. And the fact that Bitcoin has done that, like Satoshi, to these like internet nerds, sent out this blog and then disappeared off the scene. There's no marketing team or anything like that. It's just like a bunch of outrageously smart people who captured an idea and started like running with it on their own. Like, people start realizing like, wow, there's legs to this, and it's not being hyped up off of anything. Like, this is truly running on its own. Yeah. So you anchoring into that side of things, of what it is and the solution it set out to be. And then, yeah, talking through the game theory side of things though, I think that it starts tying into our current broken money system, and like you tie it back into like hyperinflation and like wealth always gravitates to the hardest form of money. Then you can start going into like why not only individuals, but also corporations, nation states would want to start adopting this. And then, going deeper into, well, because that's where people start understanding this. I had a client probably about a week ago, called me out of the blue. I introduced them to Bitcoin a while ago, and they called like, man, this is awesome. Like, they're just excited. But then they said, Jim, I'm sort of worried though. Like, do we sell? Do we buy? Like, what? You could tell that their gears were really finally starting to turn outside of just us talking. I said, well, tell me what's happening. I said, well, I've been thinking about this. It seems like it's actually a really big deal. And if it is that big of a deal, this could lead to the collapse of the Federal Reserve. Then what happens? And I was like, okay, like it was really cool that I didn't have to lead them there. And it was funny how they approach it. They approach it from this place of questioning and quasi fear-based. Mm-hmm. And I approached it of like, that was the goal all along. And I told them about Satoshi's Genesis block, how he, put in there the newspaper article. And I was like, yeah, that's sort of what we're going after here, and easing their mind there. So then like even them recognizing the end state of a large scale adoption, like again, if you anchor into the education, they'll start putting the pieces together. Like, okay, I see it. And if other people start understanding what the problem is, they're going to rush in, and suddenly like everyone's looking for a fire escape.
Mm-hmm. And so let's dive into this like path towards adoption in the game theory. How do you paint the picture or tell the story of how you view it playing out potentially? If at all.
Yeah.
Do you get into...
I try to be really measured with my words. And I really tend to try to be conservative with my language and with my proposition of things. So, I don't want to rush into like, you have to buy now because the U.S. is about to adopt a ton. But I do. I talk to people about how it sort of depends on what's going on. So, like, for instance, I do bring up with people, and I hosted a little event recently talking about like Bitcoin and the current geopolitical and macro landscape. And talking through like Trump, RFK at Bitcoin conference said, hey, we're going to take this thing as a strategic reserve. Literally what, like 2 days later, our current administration was like, all right, hey, we're going to start selling our Bitcoin. That has to be out of spite. We've been sitting on that Bitcoin for way too long for it to actually just happen to fall the next business day that they decide they're going to start selling. So, people start seeing like, okay, there is something like geopolitical happening with this money that some anonymous person online wrote about and created. Like, that's pretty big. Why is this happening? So sort of allowing them to start formulating thoughts on their own. Taking it there and then, obviously just getting people intrigued through, you know, if you mention like, oh, people in, you know, El Salvador, it's a form of money. Most people sort of like, they're like, well, that's neat, but sort of shrug it off. It's not this big thing. But I think when you start talking through, yeah, U.S. possible adoption, other countries are mining, corporations are trying to get into it. Again, not allowing that cannot be, I can't underline that enough. That cannot be your primary thesis of trying to convince someone to buy Bitcoin. It's because other people are doing it. Because the other person stops or moves to something else, they will go along with it. You know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's how many people like early adopters into Bitcoin that spoke at these conferences who like went off to do like other altcoins and stuff. How many of them took a tribe of people with them as well? Because they were following that person, not the movement. And I don't want my family, friends, clients to follow a person, an institution or anything. I want them to follow the money. So yeah, the game theory is cool. I try not to go there too much. I just try to be measured.
This is good information. Yeah. There's a ton of people on their way to their Thanksgiving destination thinking like, I'm going to, Uncle Bob's going to come out like, why should I buy Bitcoin? I'm going to be like, Larry Fink's buying Bitcoin. You're not. And you're saying that's a bad approach.
I don't think it's terrible. Again, if Uncle Bob is like a big like BlackRock apologist, that might be the way to get him like in the door. But the goal is not to just get him in the door. The goal is to get him to be a Bitcoiner, you know, and Bitcoiners don't buy Bitcoin because Larry Fink bought Bitcoin. They buy Bitcoin because Bitcoin's better money. And if it means just getting him there at first is just like, hey, Larry Fink is like, all right, well, maybe I should go buy a little bit. I think that's okay. You know, I've taken flack. Like, I think it's okay for, you know, your great aunt Doris. It's like, hey, maybe I should buy Bitcoin, but like she's just not comfortable. Maybe she lives way off away from you. And like, you feel like it'd be a really bad idea for her to go and set up an account on an exchange and get a wallet and all these things. It's like, you know what? And that's going to take her 5 more months. It's like, hey, let's just hop into your account at Fidelity. We're going to buy the ETF today just to get some exposure. I'm okay with that. I'd rather Aunt Doris own, you know, peripheral exposure to Bitcoin than nothing at all, at least to get her feet wet. So part of that, there is a place of like personality, meeting people where they're at and trying to get them in the door. And eventually people start adopting. I have clients like that. I have clients who at first it's like, wow, okay, I understand what you're saying from a monetary side of things, but Jim, I'm not quite ready yet to like do all the stuff of like buying Bitcoin, self-custody, all that. Okay, that's fine. Let's go ahead and buy these other things first. And it's inevitable that within a couple months they'll reach out and it's like, hey, I want to buy Bitcoin and what were those wallet things you're talking about? Because it's an unpacking of the implications of what's really happening. And if you can educate them enough, they're going to take that on their own and it's going to pique curiosity and they're going to start learning. I have lots of clients who have read more Bitcoin books than I have. And there are people who are like diehard Dave Ramsey fans and stuff historically. And then I just introduce them to this, give them enough where they go off, they run with it on their own. They come back to me. It's like, man, I just read this new book, blah, blah, blah. And it's really cool because they have taken this ownership. Again, it's a love of ownership versus like, I always butcher this word, obfuscating or whatever, putting your ownership onto someone else. Mm-hmm. If it's Larry Fink or a podcast or whatever.
Well, I mean, those are great example, ramps. Dave Ramsey. Like if people were just going along with Dave Ramsey, they arguably wouldn't have Bitcoin yet. So in the opposite direction, like
yeah.
The fact that you're educating your clients and forcing them to get down and understand this from a first principles perspective helps them avoid the hero worship of a Dave Ramsey-like character.
Yeah. That's what it comes down to, is it's this the danger of hero worship. And maybe your hero in Bitcoin today will become the villain.
You never know.
Yeah. So that's the risk. And I don't want to do that. If that's the case, you've missed the narrative, or you got off track at some point.
This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Salt of the Earth. You got to be hydrating, freaks. And while you're hydrating, you got to be getting your electrolytes. This is the best electrolytes mix that I've ever come into contact with. Pink Himalayan salt with calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium, no sugar. It tastes incredible. My favorite is the orange and the pink lemonade. Go to drinksote.com. That's drinksote.com. Use the code TFTC when you make your purchase and you'll get 15% off. I'm telling you, get on it, freaks. You're going to love this stuff.
In terms of the Thanksgiving Day pitch, what haven't we touched on that you think's important?
Man.
Do you ever throw out price predictions?
I am measured with my words again there, and I'll hedge myself big time. It's like, all right, here's my base case. Well, I always say this, I'm probably really wrong, because we all are in reality. I'm probably wrong. I guess someone out there is right. They don't know they're right. Just statistically, someone's got to be right, I guess. But I'm probably wrong with what I think. And that's why I'm like, here's my base case, just based off of how things normally work with Bitcoin and we see these adoptions. Here's what I think, like, now that Trump's president or will be president, here's what I think is pretty reasonable with him. Here's my outrageous guess. It's probably way off. And I'm okay to do that. But again, I don't want to anchor in. I'll be like, hey, you should buy Bitcoin. It's going to 500,000 in 6 weeks or whatever, you know? Suddenly, they're going to be disappointed if it's not there. So just trying to, again, it's, you're informing of the narrative. I think it was Pierre who had the chart of like the 4-year cycle of like greed, anxiety, fear,
disbelief.
The whole thing. Yeah. I love that chart. Because it really does help shake out, why do you have this place of euphoria and fear? And you have this new base of long-term adopters. You can tell who adopted for what reason. And the people who adopted at the end out of greed, most of them adopted because they thought it was going to go higher in a short term because, you know, ultimate fiat was the goal versus the long-term narrative of what is being built here. And you're okay if it drops. And if you do, again, you have this new base of long-term holders. So yeah, price, we all got into Bitcoin because of number go up. I mean, that's Bitcoin's money. Money's a tool to help you do what's important to in your life. And like, I don't forget that. I will, if we hit Bitcoin, let's say if Bitcoin hits 300 this cycle, I will probably sell a decent amount of Bitcoin and go buy a house in the mountains. And you'd be like, Jim, that's so stupid. If you just wait another cycle, you can buy 3 houses in the mountains, whatever. It's like, yeah, but Bitcoin's money. And having a place for my family to gather and be able to give and be generous for other people to gather as well is really important to me. And I want to use my money in that capacity. And my kids are young. I'm not going to have that much time to be with them and to make memories. So I'd rather do that now than wait another 4-year halving cycle. And that's fine. So anyways, I don't know how I got there. There's this tying of like, you can't leave what is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is money. What is money? Money is a means of communicating, storing, and transferring value. And like money, how you use your money is communicating what you value. You know, some people keep their money in US dollars or under their mattress because they really value security. Their problem is they think security is cash. They don't see that there's risk in everything you do. You know, there's people who are like, what are they called? They're like shut-ins, you know, hypochondriacs, I guess. They're afraid of everything. Mm-hmm. And they think that sitting in their house, away from everything else, away from all the elements, is the safest thing to do. The problem with that, like, you're probably gonna be vitamin D deficient if you sit in your house all day. You're probably gonna get obese. You're probably gonna have really bad mental health. So trying to protect yourself some from X risk, you're directly presenting other risks to you. And a lot of people do that unknowingly with, you know, they're buying bonds. Oh, it's the, you know, it's the risk-free asset, you know, US debt. Not understanding that there's risks in that as well. So yeah, helping people articulate, like, well, what are you risking by doing this or not doing this?
Yeah.
It's important. Like, six directions.
No. It's important to really anchor people to this. I think people are well equipped now. And you mentioned a couple different archetypes of your clients. Like, what have been like the most surprising growth stories or just stories in general of some of your clients that have gotten into Bitcoin?
I think the funniest are the hardcore Dave Ramsey people. Like, they came to me, you know, Dave Ramsey to the T. And again, I remember particularly one family I've worked with for several years. They were with me at another firm I was at. They followed me over. When I started my own company, I could finally actually really, you know, before I could talk about Bitcoin as friends, but not as clients. So finally I was like, hey guys, you should know something about me. It's Bitcoin. I was like, what do you think about it? And they were totally caught off guard. And, but we talked for a bit and they're like, all right, I want to keep learning about this. And now, like, they're convinced that Dave Ramsey, if he would actually humble himself and learn about Bitcoin, would be a hardcore Bitcoiner. I think those people are the funniest because I agree. Like, if every American just followed Dave's basic money principles, like spend less than you make, save aggressively, like things like that, the US would be in a lot healthier space financially. So I like those people because they have the simple things down. I think Bitcoin really is simple. So if you can simplify, like, well, save money, don't be greedy. Okay, we'll save this money. What is money? What's a better form of money? If you can start connecting these things on a simple basis, they'll start building on each other. So, I mean, the other people who are interesting are like engineers. Like, engineers are known in financial planning to be like the worst clients. They ask you about everything. Which, if you're trying to sell cruddy products, you don't want engineers because they're gonna, you know, take it apart and realize that it's a bad product. I like engineer clients because they start asking all the really hard questions about what Bitcoin is and how it works, the depth of it. They want to really understand it. And those people, they usually are, they take a while to get it, not because they're slow, but because they want to make sure they're not rushing into something. You know, they're auditing before they put weight on something. But once they get it, they really latch on. I mean, you see this in the Bitcoin space. A lot of like the bigger people in Bitcoin come from an engineering background.
Yeah. And I mean, moving along too, like, stay on like your client base and your business and what you do, like, what I really interested to dive into is how has portfolio construction, if at all, changed for your client base now that you've introduced Bitcoin, and with the next wave of adoption seeming like it's on the way, and Bitcoin, I think, really elevating itself into a whole another sphere of becoming a geopolitical asset. Like, how do you think it affects portfolio construction moving forward?
I want to speak to one thing right quick, sort of on this. I hear a lot like, oh, BlackRock owns it and Fidelity and stuff. So it's going to be like, it must be a conversation piece amongst financial advisors. I talk to financial advisors all the time. Most of them think I'm an idiot, like completely write me off. And they're not talking about Bitcoin. If they are, actually, I had a reporter reach out to me last week about Bitcoin adoption. He was like, man, you're the first person who would even talk to me. Everyone else, when I tell them, he said, I'm just writing a piece on, are you getting more clients or questions about Bitcoin from clients? And he said, the moment I say that, they just hang up on me. And it's like, you know why? It's because they are, but they're so tired of their clients asking about it. You ask about it as well, they're not going to have the conversation anymore. So just because we're seeing institutional adoption and even like financial institutional adoption, most financial planners are still stiff arming it. You're going to see a wave of money people start adopting Bitcoin when they can actually get paid a commission off of it, which is frustrating. But hey, I'd rather someone own it and that guy got a commission than just not own it at all. You know, what's probably going to happen is like these institutions are going to send a group of advisors to like a 1 or 2 day training course on like, what is Bitcoin and how do you sell it? They're going to come back and feel all hyped up so they can finally sell this new product and make a bunch of money off of it. So then you're going to start seeing an institutional or a managed money adoption of Bitcoin from that perspective. But we're not there yet.
Do you think we're very close? I mean, I sent this tweet out yesterday, and I think it's true. I mean, we've been talking a lot about it at 1031. We have a lot of conversations with potential LPs, particularly people at endowments, pensions, and that's one thing we caution managers about, particularly, is like it seems like the career risk around Bitcoin could be flipping, doing a complete 180, where historically up to this point, it's if you're in Bitcoin, you're taking severe career risk because if something happens, you're screwed. Now, with everything that's happening in the lead up to 2025, it seems like that's flipped. So we could, people in positions, particularly capital allocators, fiduciaries, wealth managers, could find themselves in a position where this time next year, they're getting asked questions like, why weren't we in Bitcoin? Like, why am I paying you? Do you believe that?
Yes, to an extent, because I have a lot of those people reaching out to me.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's a frustration from the client. And I would say it's, when I say I have a lot, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that many. You know, there's that meme of the guy who's standing around the perimeter of the room and the other people out there dancing. He's like, they have no idea that X. That's how, you know, like most people have no idea that Bitcoin's about to hit an all-time high. No clue. They don't know that it's being talked about as being a put on the balance sheet or that's important. Most people have no idea. And so, yes, I do have people reaching out and they're starting to come to me like, wow, this other advisor I've been working with for years, either he's never brought it up to me. And when I bring it up, it's met with frustration, or at best they'll say, here, fine, take 1% of your portfolio and buy it, so you'll shut up and stop asking me. That's how that's usually met. I think the problem is, even if you have clients asking about it, there's so much regulatory and compliance, corporate bureaucracy that's going to be a holdback as well. So like I have advisors who reach out to me all the time asking about my business and stuff. And I've talked to people who work at large institutions who've said, Jim, I want to talk to my clients about this, but I am not allowed to. I talked to a guy a few weeks ago and he was mentioning this. And I just held it and I was like, dude, is it more, basically, if he stays at that firm, he's going to make a whole lot of money. I was like, dude, I'm not saying what's right or wrong for you, but you need to decide for yourself. Is it better for you to stay here, not tell anyone about Bitcoin, but you make a lot of money, or for you to leave, go somewhere so you can actually help people in what you feel is the best way, and you're maybe not going to make as much money? Personally, I would have to do the latter. I didn't get this industry so I could make a bunch of money. I got this industry so I could help a lot of people. So yeah, I think that's going to be, I mean, you see that the same thing, like large firms. I used to get in trouble at a firm I worked at back in the day because I would talk about tax stuff a lot. Large institutions won't allow you to talk about taxes when you're doing financial planning because they have to consider like who's the biggest moron at our entire company, and they're not going to use our right verbiage. So therefore we're not going to let anyone talk about this. So I think Bitcoin from that perspective will not be sold. Not because clients aren't wanting it, but because the companies don't understand how you can properly use it. The first people to adopt it will be more of like the old school, like wirehouse broker-dealer types, like a Morgan, Merrill, BlackRock, people like that who are selling it as a product, not selling it as advice. The last people to adopt it will be, I don't know, maybe like the Ed Joneses or something like that, because they're sort of taking their time on things. Or unfortunately, I think a lot of the people will be like really good financial advisors. It's like the type of financial firm I run, it's called an RIA or registered investment advisor. Usually RIAs are like good CFP, CFA, CPA type people who really do good money management stuff. I think that those people will probably be some of the last to adopt it. And ironically, it's not, they can, like if they're working at a small shop, like I'm my compliance advisor. You know, I can say I want to talk about Bitcoin. As long as I feel like it's best for my clients, I will. Unfortunately, I think a lot of these people are so ingrained with being good at talking about money and managing money, they're too prideful to ask what is money. And these people will probably be the last to adopt it. And that's where I am seeing people come over to me because they have really good financial planners who hit everything right on everything else, but thematically have missed, but what is the money? And that's where people are starting to come over from other institutions saying, hey, I've worked with this guy for several years. He's done a good job, but it's starting to really get to me that we can't talk about this big thing because it's becoming a bigger and bigger part of what we're doing. Now you asked about how we manage, like how this impacts our portfolios. I started my company about 4 years ago. Bitcoin has always been part of it. So all of our clients have exposure to Bitcoin in some capacity. It's gobbled up a very large percentage of portfolios for our clients. Right now, if I had to guess, average client exposure to Bitcoin would be probably about 45%.
Holy shit.
About a year and a half ago, it was about 20-25%. But again, as
if function of price.
Yeah, function of price. And then, like I said, like back in whenever that was, end of 22, when Bitcoin bottomed at 16, like we were proactively saying like, hey, let's stop putting money to these other things and scoop up a lot. So when you do that, when you tell clients to buy a lot more Bitcoin at 16, it will become a larger part of your portfolio. Now we do, we manage monies. Like I have a portfolio that I run as well. That's, I call it Frankenstein, real odd thing. I have clients who own a lot of Bitcoin and, it's like, hey Jim, I fully believe in Bitcoin. I promise. I love it. I think it's gonna go up forever, but it's like, I'm 70. I need something. If Bitcoin doesn't do well in the short term, I need something else. And these people, again, on from a big picture, they want something that still aligns with their thesis of our money situation. So they don't want to own a bunch of like mid or long duration bonds because that flies in the face of their Bitcoin allocation. They don't want to just sit on a pile of cash. It's like, okay, well, what do I own to hedge against short-term volatility risk of Bitcoin? And we talk through like what would cause that. Is a 51% attack that you're talking about? Because that's a lot different than like a big macro event that takes Bitcoin down short term. It's like, okay, it's probably the macro event that's going to cause Bitcoin to blip. And if Bitcoin drops for a little bit and I'm retired, I can't risk that sequence of return risk when I'm pulling out my portfolio. It's like, oh, well, then let's carve out this other thing. So we have a portfolio that like sort of is the antithesis of Bitcoin. Back in 2020 and 21, I took a lot of flack from people. Like I did a weekly Twitter space for a company where there was like ask an advisor or anything sort of thing. And every week you'd have some knucklehead. It had to be on purpose at some point. Someone would ask me about having a US dollar emergency fund. And I would take so much heat for saying, I think you should. People are like, dude, you're such a bear and blah, blah, blah. But I've had a lot of people come back to me in the last couple of years saying like, I own a lot less Bitcoin than I did in 21 because I had to sell at 16. Mm-hmm. Basically all I own Bitcoin, I own my business, and that's about it. So I'm not a bear by any means. I want to make sure that you're protecting your Bitcoin. And sometimes that means owning a tiny bit less in a different type of asset, or there's other things you can do. I mean, if you have a lot of equity in your house, set up a HELOC and allow that to offset, and it would be like sort of an emergency fund sort of thing. So there's things you can do.
Well, let's dive into that Frankenstein portfolio. Like what does that look like? Is it mid to long duration bonds? Is it short term bonds? Is it?
No, there's no bonds in there right now. So it is, our largest current position is Berkshire. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, frankly, like I'm guessing here, but like, I think if at this moment, if Bitcoin were to go down a lot, it'd because of some like crazy macro event that everything's melting down. I would speculate that short term Berkshire would go down a lot along with everything else. You know, it's an equity. But, you know, Warren's sitting on an absolute behemoth mountain of cash, which you would take advantage of and deploy. So I think an event like that would be opportune for Berkshire Hathaway. So that's our largest position. And we get a little bit more nuanced there as well. So like we have other like value and deep value funds. Right now we own some oil and gas in that. I'm sure you know, like our strategic petroleum, our reserve is just. Well,
and the incoming energy secretary is very bullish for oil and gas. I'm not sure if you've been following that, but.
Just look at our reserves. It's like, dude, that would last us like, I don't know what's at today, but it wouldn't last us hardly any time at all. So we've got to refill that thing. We should have refilled it a few years ago when gas was super cheap. But we didn't. So here we are sitting on just a couple of weeks of strategic reserves as a nation for our oil and gas. So yeah, then everything that's talking about like, hey, if we, you know, once Trump gets in, open up these pipelines, whatever, like, so we own some of that. So yeah, there's like a lot of value, deep value, but then some commodities also like one that like we own, like right now I own Spotify in there a little bit. Like that's sort of an oddball position, but something I felt like would do well. We bought that probably about a year and a half ago, and it's done really well. We bought gold inside of that thing. That did a lot better than I anticipated it. Really, I bought this to be really, I told clients, like, look, the goal for this portfolio is to massively underperform Bitcoin. I hope that happens. But I also want to own it in case something happens with Bitcoin in the short term. This is sort of the antithetical thing to it. And it allows us to not have, like, if you're a retiree, the classic portfolio is like a 60-40 stock bond. I don't like the 60-40 portfolio. So having Frankenstein in there allows me to feel a little bit more ease of not having 40% in bonds and cash. It is a somewhat bond substitute by owning all this deep value stuff.
Yeah. I think it's a smart play. I mean, Berkshire, I mean, Warren just dumped a lot of his Bank of America stock, and it seems like he's building up that. It's approaching what? It's hundreds of billions of dollars yeah. at this point.
It's giant, like unbelievable. Yeah. It's yeah. just buy Bitcoin with it. It's a lot of weird stuff. I mean, we have exposure to India. I think on a long-term scale, internationally, I think India will outperform other international developed or developing markets over the next 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. It's a weird portfolio. That's why I call it Frankenstein.
Yeah, that is certainly a Frankenstein portfolio. I mean, but back to Bitcoin, like long-term trends, saying people knocking on your door coming from advisors that won't let them get into Bitcoin. Like, do you think that'll accelerate this cycle? And like, what is the profile of that? Is it like you're more, is it wealthier individuals is that really are looking at their wealth to be like, this is a massive golden goose I need to protect.
Yeah. It's across the board. But this time around, it's a lot more wealthy people, like wealthy older people. Like I think, and maybe this is a reflection of me, I'm 34. I think the average Bitcoiner at this moment, or at least up until recently, it was probably like a 37-year-old dude with three kids, like something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've historically seen in times like this is people 20 to 34 reach out about, hey, Bitcoin, financial planning, stuff like that. But what I'm having right now, like a lot of people reaching out are in their late 60s to 80s, and they own a substantial amount of Bitcoin, and their advisor they've been working with for the last 20 years wants to have nothing to do with it. And at first they would put up with it, but now it's a place of like, dude, I'm friends with that guy, but he's doing me a disservice with my money. I need to have someone else. I'm getting that on a very regular basis now. I'm having that conversation almost daily with, yeah, really wealthy older people, which is pretty cool to see. Like, it's not just this young person, you know, pie in the sky idea. Like, these are really smart people who have been around the block for a while.
Yeah. And I really want to dig into this. I mean, I've had this thesis for a while, and you alluded to it, the RIA, the broader RIA, particularly like your big box RIA shops, like all they care about is the fees, and does Bitcoin as this better money, this better store of value, really eat into the industry in which you play in?
I love that. Man, so good. I wish our money was better. It would make so much of my job not necessary. Like, remember a couple of years ago, it was like 21 when that, like in New Braunfels where I live, the average house went up in value by 30%. That's crazy. Your house, my house at that time, at that point we had three kids. Like, our house went up by 30% in value. That did not happen. Like, our kids were putting holes in the sheetrock with their heads and just crazy stuff. Our house was getting trashed. The house didn't get better. Our money got cheaper. That's what happened. So I had clients come to me, hey Jim, I want to buy a house in the next year. How do I save for that thing? Like, do I put in the S&P and hope the S&P doesn't plummet, which ended up happening, you know, in 22, the S&P went down by like, what, 23% or something like that? Do you put in the stock market and hope that you can keep up with the housing market? Do you keep it in cash in risk that houses keep going up by 30%? Do you put it in bonds and try to clip some coupons? Like, what do I do with this? That's a question I had all the time. And that would be a non-issue if our money wasn't just broken. Like, we had people scrambling. The houses went up by 30% because of the new money creation. The new money creation itself made everything rise in price. And plus, like, when you have the monetization of assets, like, you weren't, a few years ago, you wouldn't go buy a house. You're not just competing against me and, you know, some other nice young couple. You're competing against, like, BlackRock and private equity companies. And the reason they're doing that is because they know they have to park money in something that can keep up at least with inflation. And once Bitcoin takes that role, at least they recognize it does, that's going to leave, to an extent, is going to leave real estate and go to Bitcoin. And that'll be fantastic. I hope those parts of my job get taken over. I would love that because I want to help simplify and better people's financial lives. And a lot of things I have to talk about shouldn't exist. So yeah, I think that will happen. I talked to someone yesterday afternoon. She said they're looking for a financial planner. They just pay flat dollar amount to. She said, I think it's crazy that financial planners will charge a percentage of assets under management. And I do allow for flat fees, but I played sort of devil's advocate. I said, I completely agree. So here's what you see in this industry is most good, like RIA types say, I don't bring any value through investment management, or maybe the extent of the value I can bring through investments is behavioral investing and rebalancing and some tax loss harvesting. But that's the value we bring through the investments. Really the value that we bring is through tax planning and equity compensation planning and business strategy and tax and estate. Those are the areas we can bring deep value to. But then you have this weird thing of, you just said you bring no value through the investments, yet you tie your income to 1% of the investment rate. And I think public's starting to see through that and say, like, you're going to charge me 20 grand on a whatever $2 million portfolio when you just said the value you bring is not even related to the value of my portfolio, but these other things, I'm going to pay you a flat fee. Anyways, I talked to a lady yesterday who said that. I was like, yeah, if that's the case, you should go hire a robo-advisor, pay it 20 basis points. Don't hire an advisor and pay it 150. But that's where I did meet her and say, well, like, that is the case of most advisors are just going to buy the index and call it a day. Like, well, yeah, why would you pay someone 150 basis points to do that? It doesn't make any sense. But I could counter that with, like, well, here's how we manage our money. Like, I can fully sleep at night having someone else pay us 1% on how we manage money. Like, because we beat the crud out of the market, or at least we have. So anyways, I hope it makes it where I think financial advisors will always be necessary because there's just decisions. Like, so much of my job is emotional. Like, I have clients who are, most of my clients are a lot smarter than me. I'm not that smart. So it's not a big hurdle. But I have clients who really understand the money, who are super successful with it, have great marriages. But when you meet the money and the marriage together, there's a lot of angst. And a lot of my job is to come in, help them communicate better and have a plan together. And then once you've done that, you can actually build better. So, like, there's a family I'm working with right now. They have two financial advisors outside. One's a great financial planner, one's not. They have about $40 million net worth. We were talking, they hired me to audit their other financial advisors. And we were talking, and after one conversation, the wife said, I just don't feel like we have a plan. And she wanted her husband to sell most of their Bitcoin. They're sitting on a pretty good amount of Bitcoin. She said, she really wants him to sell it. She said, I just don't feel like we have a plan. I was like, that's ironic because you have two financial planners. And what we realized is they never had someone to step in the middle of their conversations and facilitate healthy vision for them. Like, hey, you're saying these things are important to you. You're saying these things are important to you. You're saying the same things. You're just approaching it from different directions. And what I was able to do is they could actually articulate that. I could actually show there is a plan that exists. And because of that, now the wife feels way more comfortable with the husband buying even more Bitcoin because you could at least articulate what is the vision, what we're trying to build. So I think there will always be good value for having a financial planner. I just hope a lot of, like, the day-to-day stuff does get removed from better money.
Yeah. No, and I wasn't attacking you. And I think what you do, like, boutique, like, personal, like, one-to-one, Like, you make a personal relationship with your clients is very important and will be around for a while. I'm talking about like the Ameriprises, like all these sort of factory RIAs that.
Yeah. I mean, what I see a lot, like what I tell people all the time is like, there's a huge difference between a financial planner and a salesperson who just happens to sell a financial product.
Yeah. Like I was with somebody last week, we were getting drinks at the Driscoll, and they were talking about their Fidelity advisor. He's like, yeah, they call me once a quarter, and some 24-year-old who is just reading from the script of products they've been told to sell like this quarter.
That's I worked maybe there or somewhere like there. I'm getting in trouble all the time for like talking about tax stuff. Or like, yeah, you're limited on. There's someone on Twitter the other day who put on like they're asking about buying Bitcoin. They want to help their mom buy Bitcoin at Fidelity, but their advisor always tells them no. It's like, yeah, that's because they can only sell these three model portfolios or whatever. Like, that's it. And there's nothing personal about it. There's nothing about leaving the script. The moment you introduce a better form of preserving your capital, a lot of that script is no longer necessary. Again, I love the idea of demonetizing these other assets. Suddenly you don't have to use the VTI as a savings account. Use Bitcoin as your savings account. That's what money is for. Money is there to preserve your purchasing power. So I hope this stuff happens. That's something that's really interesting to talk through with going back to the family. Like, you know, how much Bitcoin should I own? So I wrote a paper a while back. I did not publish my thoughts on a number because I didn't want to like compliance to get down my back or the SEC or whatever. So I didn't publish a number, but like if you're doing my research, I did like, okay, if Bitcoin does what I think it'll do, well, one.
New all-time high.
Hey, we did it. It's like a.
Are we live right now? Are people smash buying as we record? I'm kidding.
I want to be like Lieutenant Dan right now on New Year's Eve. With Bitcoin to go, if Bitcoin does what we think it'll do, it literally has to do that to the detriment of other assets. Like Bitcoin's value in real terms, not nominal, but in real terms, will go up because other assets lose purchasing power in real terms.
Value is sucked into Bitcoin.
Yeah. And that value is going to get sucked out of gold, real estate, stocks, bonds, money, art, whatever. And I think people start realizing, okay, the theme here, so that's where it really is. Like, I think it's dangerous to not own any Bitcoin. Well, why is that? Because you're the true value. Of course, the government can make it look like the value is retained by just, you know, pumping up the numbers there, but the purchasing power itself is being diminished. And I think when people start realizing that, it's like, maybe I should own at least a little bit. And I haven't run the numbers in a while, but like that point, it was like my numbers at that point was if you own 4% of your total portfolio in Bitcoin, as the purchasing power gets sucked out of other assets and put into Bitcoin, you would stay equivalent in purchasing power long term. If you own more than 4%, your total purchasing power would rise. If you own less than 4%, it would go down. That was my thought. I'm curious to actually run the numbers now that it's gone up significantly since then. I'm sure it hasn't changed. You know, if we're looking grand scheme of thing, Bitcoin, a zillion dollars, it's probably moved from like 4 to like 4.3% of your portfolio or something like that. But I think that's really, that could be something interesting to bring up to family. You know, that wouldn't be my leading conversation point is like, hey, you know, if Bitcoin sucks all the monetary value of all assets in the world, you should probably own 4% of your portfolio. Like that's not a leading thing because they're not going to understand remotely close. Like again, like the game theory of how you arrive at VTI and rental properties going down in value to go to Bitcoin. Like, why is that? Because they don't understand that they're using those things as money. So you have to go back to what is money? So it all goes back to that simple thing. Like it is first principles. What's money? Bitcoin. Bitcoin's better money. Houses are really bad money, but they're being used as money right now because our actual money is broken.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, leaning into houses and particularly rental properties to get that cash flowing income stream, I think 2021 really drove a lot of people towards Bitcoin, not then, but now, because you had that crazy expansion of the monetary base, ZERP. And then people went and bought a bunch of Airbnbs and thought they were going to be able to do the FIRE lifestyle and retire on the cash flows from their Airbnbs, the rental properties. And that quickly got cut at the knees. And I've anecdotally know quite a few people that did that and wound up just like eating a loss in the properties and throwing it into Bitcoin. They're like, because when you think about it, like the maintenance, the logistical headaches of trying to manage a portfolio of these rental properties, particularly if you're not a professional and you're just getting into it as a side gig to fire, to retire early and live off that income. It's insane.
Yeah.
Compared to the alternative Bitcoin, which is just like, you get the scarce asset, very liquid, very easy to secure, and very likely that more people are going to adopt it. I think particularly in the rental housing market, people are waking up to that.
Dude, my wife and I, her name's Kendra. Kendra and I are renting right now. We I don't know, gosh, a little over a year ago, like, hey, what if we sold our house? So we can buy more Bitcoin. Like, all right, let's do that. And I love it. Stuff breaks all the time. And like the other day, our AC went out last week. And the first thing that went to mind was like, hey, not my AC to fix. Like, suddenly you're trying to build this portfolio of something that has, you know, you have to think of like CapEx, repairs, vacancies, like.
And then you don't control all the variables. It's like, oh,
yeah,
the Siders moved in, they're wrecking the house. I
yeah.
Can't, yeah.
There's a, yeah. oh man.
I'm kidding.
Yeah. I mean, four young kids is tough on a place. That's another nice thing about, you know, we've thought about building something like a good forever home. It's like, I don't think we're there yet as a family. I could do drywall repairs all the time on it. Now that's, I think people, I agree. People start realizing there's an easier way to preserve my money than real estate. I think real estate will probably be the first asset to really have this demonetization sucked out of to move to Bitcoin. Personally, that's probably where I'd go first. Like, it would just be a pain. Then again, I'm like, I'm not a good hands-on. If we measured manliness based off of like your ability to fix stuff, I'm really doing bad in that area.
Yeah.
So I would not be a good property manager. I guess you can hire a property manager, but there goes 10% of your gross revenue. Again, like it's getting taken away left and right. I think people are starting to realize like, crud, there's something out there. There's gotta be something that I can buy, put in this little device or in my, you know, 12 words in my head and then forget about it. And I'm not paying for repairs and all that stuff. So, I'm curious to see how this plays out. You know, you asked earlier about the whole game theory, the nation state adoption. It is interesting. Like you start looking at where we are with like not just Trump, but it's like his cabinet and he's lining up. Like I think Trump's sort of a goober. Like I don't think he understands Bitcoin that well. Maybe he does, and he's just playing his cards close. But I think he does have people close to him understand it. Mm-hmm. Like it seems that Vivek knows a little bit about it, that JD Vance understands it.
Vivek's been on this show. Yeah. Knows about Bitcoin.
JD, like he had to disclose his assets when he was elected as the VP elect. And like he owns a pretty good amount of Bitcoin, like a decent amount of his net worth. So I think people actually understand it. So that's what's really curious. That was a point I want to make earlier. You asked game theory. This is the game theory that actually excites me. Is back in July, Trump and RFK said, hey, we want to own $200,000 Bitcoin as our strategic reserve. What's
more than that? A million, right?
Well, back it was at the conference. It was 200 because that's what we owned.
Yeah,
that we confiscated through Silk Road and stuff. That's what they wanted to keep. Like, all right, we're going to take that. We're basically, if we had done that, if current admin had not sold some, what would have happened is theoretically, Trump gets in presidency, he moves our 200,000 Bitcoin and just like relabels it as like instead of like confiscated assets or whatever it's called right now on our balance sheet. And we actually give a title of like strategic reserve. That'd be a cool move. But what's way neater now is if he's going to be like true to his word, let's say it's not even a million. He just gets back to the $200,000 Bitcoin he initially said. We have to proactively go buy it. So before it was a passive retitling of what the Bitcoin is. Now we have sold some of that 200,000 Bitcoin. So we have to go buy some now. That is much more of a signal move. The US government purposely went and actually bought Bitcoin to build up a reserve. So even if it's just the 200,000 that we initially said, the signaling there is way higher. So what current administration set out to do in order to start selling our Bitcoin, I think will actually lend itself to being way more bullish signal over the long term. I think that's really cool. Even if it's not, you know, Lummis's million Bitcoin proposal, even if it's just 200,000.
Yeah. I mean, Bitcoiner has been talking about this for 15 years, like the nation state game theory. And I mean, it has played out somewhat, like has been presented by these conversations over the years, which is the smaller, more nimble governments that have much less to lose and much more to gain will move first. We've seen that with El Salvador, Bhutan,
Obviously, Russia, many people surmise, has some Bitcoin. Venezuela. And that's played out. I'm honestly surprised that Strategic Reserve in the United States is part of the conversation now. I think that throws a wrench in the game theory in how many believed it would play out.
Dude, the acceleration.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, one might say, gradually then suddenly. Yeah. Like, we very well, maybe we're not. Again, I don't talk about these things with clients and stuff like much, unless it's like I can trust that they're not going to take it as speculative hype. I don't go there very often because I don't want to build up this like crazy expectation. But I think there's a decent chance we are about to enter like the suddenly phase. Like, we're on the right on the threshold.
Yeah, we're looking over the cliff right now. Like, are we going to jump?
Yeah,
We got our squirrel suit really on. Like, let's go.
I'm really. Yeah.
All right. Not financial advice, but what happens if we do take the jump off the cliff?
Oh, gosh.
That's probably a bad analogy. Like, we're get in the rocket ship.
We hit in a rocket ship. man, I will be a little bit sad personally. It's like where I'm at right now is last few cycles. You know, I'm like Lieutenant Dan, Bitcoin goes up some and I'm sort of excited on my own, but yeah, cool. I figure this is going to happen and we'll just keep going. This time around, over the last 4 years, I've managed to convince 100 families to adopt Bitcoin. So right now it's like super fun. So like, I have people reaching out to me all the time, like, wow, Jim, like, thank you so much. This is awesome. Like, changing individuals' lives, changing like generations, which is so rewarding. So I love this. And I, right now, frankly, I could stop bringing on new clients. I would probably be able to trim my work down to like 3 days a week, make a good living and be done. But I know there's so many bad advisors out there who are telling their clients to like, don't buy Bitcoin. It's tulips and beanie babies. They're not even doing like good, like tax planning and stuff like that, let alone talking about Bitcoin. And that motivates me. It's like, I could be done growing, but I need to go reach more of those people. So the reason I'd be sad if Bitcoin, this is it, and just goes up forever at this point, is that gives me less time to reach more of those people. And of course, like, eventually everyone should own Bitcoin because it's just better money. Like, one day Bitcoin will be really boring to talk about.
Yeah.
This is gonna be like, well, what if Bitcoin stops going up? It's like, that's the point of it. Like, the purpose of Bitcoin eventually is just to be super stable. One day we'll be there. Yeah, part of me wants to see that. Like, that'd be cool for me and for the clients who already own it. But it's like, dang, there's more people out there I want to get on these boats. You know, yeah. So that would be the sad part.
No, I agree. That's like one of the most rewarding things at 1031 is we have a lot of large family offices that are backing us. And when you've developed these relationships and convinced them that we are good fiduciaries for your money to allocate into the space, you learn about how they built their wealth and they're really inspiring stories. And by sitting down with them and learning how they built their wealth and their life stories, like, you feel compassionate about, like, I really feel a duty to make sure that we don't only preserve this wealth but grow it immensely, because people work hard for their money, and it would be a great shame, and it will be a great shame for the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people out there who've built a solid nest egg or potentially a great amount of wealth that see it get eaten into because they didn't have the proper advice from the people who are supposed to be planning their financial future.
It will be almost like, to an extent, like sort of a jubilee though. Like, there's people, like, I have friends and family and lots of people who like work really normal jobs who have just managed to stack a pretty good amount of Bitcoin. And like, Bitcoin does what you and I think it will do. Like, they just went from being like the blue collar person who can hopefully retire at 67 to being like, hey, let's talk about generationally now. That's really cool. I just want to, again, that's what bothers me is the people out there who I want them to be there. They're just not there yet. That's what the thing about our current money system that frustrates me the most. Like, every time I think about it, like, I like start tearing up. Like, 21 when the inflation started really heating up. You know, we think about the impacts of inflation and we get frustrated, but when food prices started going up a lot out of quote unquote nowhere, I was at the grocery store, and there's an old lady behind me in line, and she had to be like your cliche cat lady. Like, I mean, she had like hot dogs and cat food. That's it. And one other item. And I checked out and I was bagging my groceries, and she starts going, and the lady, she rang up her like three items. And the old lady was like, she had to verify, like, that's how much this cost. And she had to put one of those things back and, like, intervene. But, like, it's like, dang, that's what drives me nuts about her money. Like, I picture her, maybe I'm painting the wrong picture, but I know there's people like this, like, old lady, husband died when he was 64. She got his pension that doesn't have a COLA, or maybe it's like a 2% cost of living adjustment. Now she's 84 and she's living off that little tiny pension that just lost 40% of its purchasing power. And now she's deciding between, does she eat hot dogs for two meals a day? Does she feed her cats? Or does she get evicted from her house that she and her husband built her family in? Like, that
is infuriating.
That's where it gets real. It's like, dude, I don't care about, yes, one day I would love to have a house in the mountains for my family and I, like, that'd be so nice. Like, dude, our money's broken. I mean, think about those people. Like, it's not about what else can they buy. It's like, dude, you're messing with people's lives.
Yeah. I think Walmart's financials dropped this morning, and that was the one headline that stuck out to me, and people are reporting on it, is their biggest growth demo was individuals and families making more than $100,000. And so, like, Walmart is becoming this place where typically it's what many would deem to be the place where low-income individuals go to shop and do their bargain shopping, and, like, people that were not too long ago considered middle, maybe even upper middle class in some respects, are being forced to go to the bargain shopping center, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's, you know, like $100,000 in what it used to be. You're like, oh, you know, like, growing up is like, oh, one day I'll make six figures. You know, now, like, I talk to people all the time who just reach out. It's like, dude, just put an hour of my time. I'll give you free time just to talk. And I hear stories, like, regularly. Like, I talked to someone just recently, dual income household, travel nurse, so they can make a little bit more money versus being a nurse at home. They want to buy a house, like, somewhere really inexpensive, like deep south. That's like, so they want to do that so they can have kids. And it's like, we want to do that, but we can't. I want to be a stay at home mom, you know, with the kids, but, like, we can't afford it. It's like, that's crazy that. It's really tough for families to be able to start having kids and have a parent that stays at home despite having, like, a master's degree in nursing, all that stuff. Like, we just made it so difficult. And that's where you're seeing this sucking out of, it's not just money. Like, money helps you do what's important to you. Like, money, the reason I got into finance in the first place, money's the number one cause of divorce. It's one of the top causes of stress and suicide. Like, what, men are about 50% of the population, but are about 80% of suicide. I think that has a lot to do with, like, men are usually the one who is more responsible for the money in a household. Like, that strikes a nerve. You know, it's like, do you want to get ticked off about our currency? Like, look at the impacts. Like, you are stealing from people's ability to do the things they value. Because suddenly you're taking that so we can, what, leave a whole bunch of choppers in Afghanistan that now they're using as for their parades, credit like that. Like, they just created that money. Why do I have to pay the taxes? Suddenly it's harder for me to buy these things. Suddenly, like, everyone feels like they need to go to Walmart and buy less quality goods. Like, now your kids are eating crud because you can't afford good food. Isn't organic, whatever, like, or even not organic, like, avocados didn't get 40% nutritious in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Your money that's used to buy them just got devalued. So it's like, well, gosh, I guess we can't buy these things. I guess we can't buy organic beef or whatever, like, fruit. We have to buy these other things. You go to the store, like, it's interesting, the people, you notice this, like, I think you'd be blind to not see it. Like, people who are generally healthier are also in a higher socioeconomical demographic. You go to the store and you see someone who just looks like they're sort of rough around the edges. Look in the grocery basket. They probably have a lot of really processed junk. And of course, we could say, well, eat less, but eat less quality stuff. But, like, I just don't think that should even have to be a conversation point.
Right.
Man, that gets me riled up. Like, the impacts it actually has on people. Like, the disease that introduces. The angst in homes. Parents fighting about money. Because, like, well, you know, I want to make sure we can do these things. Like, but we can't, babe. I have to keep going. I wish you had more time to view this. Yeah, me too. But I can't because of this stuff. There's a level of theft of time. You know, like, that's infuriating.
It's infuriating. And, and it's corrosive to society. Cause you mentioned, like, I want to go buy a house in the woods or in the mountains. And I'm many Bitcoiners are thinking that way, myself included, like, what am I going to do next? But I think it's important to anchor to the fact that we live in a society, and yes, Bitcoin may go up and you may be able to afford that house by the beach or that house in the mountains. But if society devolves around you to a certain extent, like, and you can't coordinate economic activity and you have essentially this drastically more divergent two-tiered society, it's not going to be worth living in to some extent, right? And so that, I mean, that's why we have Fix the Money, Fix the World out here, and why, I mean, obviously, like you said, all get into Bitcoin for number go up at the beginning, but I think as you go further down the rabbit hole, it's like, oh no, this is like a problem that is at the core of society, and if we don't fix it, things can devolve rather quickly.
Yeah.
And that's why we do the show. That's why we do what we do, trying to push this forward. And I think it's important that we get as many people on the lifeboat. And I think I agree with you now, if we're in the suddenly phase and we accelerate and you have a mass of people that are missing out, that it would be incredibly sad, which is why it is very important that you guys crush your Thanksgiving Day dinner presentations. Okay.
Hope your PowerPoint's ready.
It is your moral duty.
Yeah. It's, I guess, closing thought there would be, again, like, when you go back to the role that money has, you know, there are times that it's tempting to be like, dude, have fun staying poor. And there are people who, like, I have a few people that I know that's like, that's how I have to approach them. That is not the norm. Most people need to be met with, like, they have financial stress and angst. They have concerns. They have concerns about their current state, and they also have concerns about Bitcoin. Their concerns about Bitcoin is the unknown. So go there, address that. They think they know something. They think they know that it's used to buy drugs, or they think they know that it's going to boil oceans, or they think they know that whatever. So address that first, and then build in proper education. Don't try to educate them about stuff they don't need to know yet. Like, if you think about your Bitcoin journey, maybe you're an engineer and your first place of really getting into this was hash rate and all that stuff. But most people aren't like you. So take it from where they are. And that is a worry about, you know, getting to Thanksgiving was expensive. And like, that was a big sacrifice. Well, why is that? What is the problem itself? And that problem is money. The money has been, it's centralized control, which allows for a printing of new units. Like, okay, well, what's the way around this? So, I know it can be tough to retain that composure. But I think if you can just anchor into remembering, like, dude, money is an expression of values. And these people, everyone values things. Most people value relationships the most. So if you can go back there, and even if it's in the back of your mind, like, why are you having this conversation? It's because you care about them. You want them to able to invest in their relationships with their families and the people they love. It's like, okay, then it's important that I can try to retain my composure so I can help them understand Bitcoin, so therefore they can do these things.
Yeah. Optimistic too. This is a way where you can help yourself. Were you worried about the plane ticket? The tank of gas, the train ticket you had to take to get to Thanksgiving, were you worried about chipping in? Was your casserole a little bit more expensive? Because the money's broken. We found a solution to the broken money problem, and we can make the world a better place. We can make your life easier. It's not, I think, reframing to an optimistic, like, if you adopt Bitcoin, things are going to get easier, instead of, if you don't adopt Bitcoin, the world's going to shit, you're going to miss out. Positive connotation's important, too, as well.
Yeah, don't want to. Yeah, especially at Thanksgiving, try to show some thanks.
So be prepared, get the presentation ready, get your ref links for your exchanges if you got them. You know, you might as well stack a little bit if you're going to onboard people to stacking apps on Thanksgiving, and right before dessert, between the main course and dessert, you have a family smash buy. You all get together, you pull out your phones, you smash buy a little Bitcoin. I'm kidding, but good luck. As you're going to pitch, Jim, where can people find out more about what you're doing, reach out to you if they're interested in leveraging your services, if you're offering them?
Yeah, you can follow my Twitter or X. I will finally yield to calling it X. After what Elon's done over the last few months, like, fine, I'll call it X now. So you can follow me on X. It's Jim Kreider TX is in Texas. My website's it's Intentional Living FP, as in financial planning. So intentionallivingfp.com. On there, there's 15 minutes on my calendar. If you just want to throw, again, if you have some weird one-off question, you don't want a financial planner, but it's like, if I could just answer this one question, noodle it with someone else, throw a minute on my calendar. Or if it's like, dude, I have this family member that I cannot get through, but if they hurt for someone else, like, awesome. Like, schedule time, more than happy to talk, help in any way I possibly can.
Jim, it's been incredible. I flung this topic on you. You crushed it.
No, I appreciate you having me.
Peace and love, freaks.